Why do parents find it tough? Genesis 25, beginning with verse 27. I have three passages from 25 and 26 to cover the three ideas that I want to share with you. Genesis 25, beginning with verse 27, and the first couple of verses simply illustrates the idea of the differences in persons in the same family. And the boys, meaning Jacob and Esau. And the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field. And Jacob was a plain man, dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob. The second series tells the difficulty related to making a living in a family. 17 of chapter 26. 26:17. And Isaac departed thence, and pitched his tent in the valley of Gerar, and dwelt there. And Isaac digged again the wells of water which they had digged in the days of Abraham his father, for the Philistines had stopped them after the death of Abraham. And he called their names after the names by which his father had called them. And Isaac's servants digged in the valley, and found there a well of springing water. And the herdmen of Gerar did strive with Isaac's herdmen, saying, "The water's ours." And he called the name of the well Esek, because they strove with him. And they digged another well and strove for that also, and he called the name of it Sitnah. And he removed from thence and digged another well, and for that they strove not, and he called the name of it Rehoboth. And he said, "For now the Lord hath made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land." The last idea is the problem of independent decisions on the part of the members of the same family. Last two verses of Genesis 26. And Esau was 40 years old when he took to wife Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Bashemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, which were a grief of mind unto Isaac and to Rebekah. You'll notice that his wives were a grief of mind, not to him, but to his parents, Isaac and Rebekah. Why do parents find it tough? Parents find it tough because they have children. All you have to do is to investigate the statistics of what happens to childless couples, and you realize that the divorce statistics are worse for those who have children than those who do not. To have children in order to save your marriage is a fruitless effort, and it's going to be costly in addition. The statistics show that that children will contribute very definitely and in measurable ways to the destruction of families. Why do parents find it tough? If you go back just the chapter before the one that I gave to you, from which I started reading this morning, 25, go back to 24, you will discover one of the most beautiful love stories in the history of literature. It's truncated, that is to say, it's short. We do not have very many details, but I think we could provide the details. Now, Isaac had been brought up largely by his mother, I'm sure. The reason why he was brought up by his mother is simply because he could identify more fully with her. He was more like her. She must have had considerably more time for him than Abraham had. There is no question in my mind but that Abraham was perhaps the greatest person to have lived in his time. Abraham was the kind of fellow that had what we might call the Midas touch, or any other kind of touch that you want to identify with success. He could stand with his nephew Lot on the hillside and he could say, "Take whatever you want and I'll take what's left and I'll still beat you." Now, he wouldn't have said that to his nephew, but he could have said that to his nephew. His nephew looked at the watered valley, took the watered valley, and left Abraham with a rocky hillside, and you already know how Abraham beat him out as far as economics were concerned with the hillside, and ultimately spiritually too in every other way. In other words, Abraham was the kind of fellow that could make and lose fortunes if he wanted to and make them back again. There are people who are put together like that. You cannot analyze them. You can't understand them. They are gifted persons, and Abraham was an exceedingly gifted man. If my purpose this morning were to describe Abraham to you, I could understand fully why it is that out of his love, God's love for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he gave us such marvelous truth. And he gave us Israel, and he ultimately gave us part of our redemption as a consequence of his love for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is his word. Now, Isaac could not match his father. For some reason, a son wants to surpass his father. And not all sons will surpass their fathers. And when they do not, it behooves the father to be wise enough, intelligent enough, to work with his son so that his son does not feel that he has to match his father. Love for one's father does not mean the emulation of one's father. Doesn't mean that at all. Now, it's interesting that most fathers who truly love their sons exult in the fact that their sons do surpass them. The father is not offended at it, but the son is in many instances. That is to say, the son is offended if he doesn't emulate his father. The father seems not, if he truly loves his son, offended if his son surpasses him. Now, Isaac simply could not match his father. Isaac wasn't put together that way, as we will readily discover in reading the short story of his life. But one thing about Isaac was that he had a beauty about his character, his nature, that is the kind of beauty that I would like to have in my own life. Isaac was, in my opinion, a marvelous fellow, though he could not reach the heights of his father. He could identify with his mother. I'm sure when he had difficulties, he went to his mother. This didn't mean that his mother made him an effeminate person. He was not that. It simply meant that his mother had more of the parallels in her thinking and her personality than Abraham did with Isaac. Therefore, Isaac turned to his mother, and his mother grew old and died. Isaac was devastated. And then you have this beautiful little section in the 24th chapter that tells the story of love between Isaac and Rebekah. Isaac was devastated in the death of his mother, and Rebekah comes. And we read that that Isaac took Rebekah into his mother Sarah's tent, and he loved her. And he was comforted in the death of his mother by his wife. For my money, that is one of the most beautiful of love stories, despite the fact we have only a couple of verses to tell us the story. Isaac's love story with Rebekah is absolutely sublime, as far as I'm concerned. The relationship between any other two persons in the love stories you know about in literature will not compare, in my opinion, to the beauty of the love story between Isaac and Rebekah. Now, the next thing I want you to remember, keep that in the background. The next thing I want you to remember is that when we talk about Isaac and Rebekah, we're talking about God's choice people. Many times he talks about his love for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Therefore, we have right in the middle of this triumvirate, we have the person of Isaac. So when we talk about the tragedy that strikes Isaac and Rebekah, when we talk about that tragedy, we are talking not about some remote individual or individuals. We're not talking about non-Christians in the Old Testament sense. We're not talking about anyone else than God's choice people. And God's choice people can choose terrible tragedy. And I call it tragedy because it could go another direction. Tragedy is always simply this, that the person chooses the tragic road that he's going to take. He could choose another road, but he chooses it. Tragedy doesn't happen by accident. Tragedy is choice. You see, Hamlet made his choice. He knew that the choice that he took was going to lead, at least to the death of loved ones, if not himself. And it led to the death of both loved ones and himself. He chose that road. Isaac and Rebekah chose the road of tragedy. They may not have realized all that they chose, but they chose it nonetheless. Now, what happened in this idyllic situation? They had children. They not only had one child, but they had two at once. Double jeopardy. Now, the children were born, and the names given to the two children were simply, of course, Jacob and Esau. The trouble begins right from the beginning. Here are two people who love each other so much that the only person in the whole world who can comfort the man, Isaac, is his wife Rebekah on the death of his mother. Now we have the introduction of two sons, twin sons, Esau and Jacob. And something suddenly seems to happen. Now it doesn't happen suddenly, but it happens as a consequence of the coming of the two sons. Now, since these were given to us for ensamples that we may believe and understand, there is no doubt in my mind that God gave us the story to recognize in our own experience, their experience, or their experience in ours, The same thing happens in our time. A couple meet. They ultimately marry. And everything is fine and dandy. In the morning, she can get up and get breakfast, and she can even gussy up a little bit for the occasion. Her hair looks decent, and she, you know, very exotically dressed. And they go and have breakfast, if they can keep their minds on it. And then he goes off to work, and she has a cheery voice for him, even if she goes back to Goonie Land for a time. And he goes off to work, and then he comes back in the evening, and now she can be all freshened up, and everything is fine and cheerful and happy and all the rest of it. And if suddenly he decides they want to do something, they can do something without asking anyone, by your leave or arranging for babysitters or anything of the kind, and off they go. In other words, the original relationship between a husband and wife is selfish. She can be selfish and he can be selfish. They can be selfish toward each other. They can be selfish toward themselves. And one of them can contribute to it simply out of a love and consideration for the other one. Their relationship, though that relationship has love in it, has a good deal of selfishness in it. But they can afford that. There's no real objection to it. The cost of living isn't going to be nearly as great as it's about to be. And now they have a child. Or in the case of this couple, they had two children, twins. Now what happens? Suddenly she now must divide her loyalties and her time between this man and this baby. Because there are certain things about this baby that's going to require attention, friends, from both directions. She's going to have to spend time. She's going to have to get up in the night, or at least one of them's going to have to. And before you know it, she is beginning to spend time with the child that formerly had been given to him. And since he already has both the male ego and the human selfishness that goes together, he begins to wonder where her devotion really lies. In addition to that, he begins to feel a certain amount of obligation, and he begins to moonlight and begins to pick up time that he can get pay for or some such thing, and after a while he becomes obligated in certain kinds of ways in the hope that he can provide a better living for his wife and child. She begins to think that he has lost some of his romantic interest in her, which may be possible, and he begins to think that she no longer loves him as intensely as she did before because she has so much time for the baby. And by the way, the studies show that indeed that's exactly what happened. Instead of permitting her love to enlarge itself so that the dimensions become large enough to include him and the child also, she keeps the dimensions just about what they were before, and now she divides it up. Most wives do not understand that their love can expand. Their love can expand so that it does not in any way reduce itself from her husband, and yet at the same time can become all-inclusive to her children. I have counseled a great many married couples where the man told me straightforwardly when he believed that I would keep his counsel and she wasn't listening, I don't believe she loves me as much now, she loves the children more. And we have a study that shows that 87% of the women admit that the first thing in their lives are their children. And that the same percentage of women say that they look upon their husbands as providers. As providers. 87%. This study was made in Chicago by Roosevelt College, and as a consequence of the study investigating 1,000 couples at random and 1,000 wives in particular, they discovered that these women did not look upon their husbands as lovers, did not even look upon them particularly as husbands, but 87% of the women said that the number one purpose of their husband was as a provider. That is to say, a meal ticket. Now, you can be sure of this, that marriage is going to have a great deal of trouble if that is the way we observe one another. If that's the way a wife looks at her husband. In many instances, the husband, on the other hand, will look upon his wife as one who becomes the person that gives him a central point, a place where he can have his laundry done, and a place where he can get food if he's on time. And we begin to lose the relationship that was born at the beginning and ought to continue all the way through our marital experience. All the way through. Because our children become an interference. And if you check the divorce statistics, you'll discover that people who have children get divorces at a greater percentage of rate than people who do not have children. In other words, we are not generally mature enough to include children in our relationship. We are not, generally, if we follow the statistics very carefully. Now, after a while, our children begin to draw out of us a great deal of immaturity. And one of the first signs of immaturity is when we begin to show favoritism, when we begin to turn away from one another toward the children. It was one of the acts of our experience as our children got older was to remind them, and I remember telling each one of my children, if there comes a difference between you and your mother, even if your mother's wrong, I vote for your mother. Don't forget that. Now, I thought at the time that I said that in an attempt to establish a relationship because they were trying to play one off against the other. I thought that that might be a bit harsh, and it turned out to be one of the smartest things I ever told my children. Because that gave them a sense of solidarity in their home. They came to realize that they could not get Dad to say one thing and Mom to say another. And if they would ask me, I would say, have you talked to your mother about it? If the answer was no, I could give a decision because I knew that if they didn't like the decision and they went to their mother for another bit of counsel, that the mother would say, that my wife would say to them, did you talk to your father about it? And, of course, we were tested on occasion in which there was a little prevarication, in which, no, I didn't talk to him about it. Not exactly. You know, there are synonyms for what you said before, so you didn't talk to him exactly that way. And you see, you get caught once in a while in the wisdom of these kids. But what happened to Isaac and Rebecca? Isaac and Rebecca began to do some of the funniest things that you could imagine. They saw their two sons who were poles apart. Esau was a man's man, great, big, brawny, swarthy fellow who could go out into the woods and he knew where the game was. He knew where the fishing holes were. He knew how to live out there. He could have survived anywhere. That was Esau. Now Jacob was something else again. Jacob was smooth of skin. I am quite sure that Jacob, no wonder his mother loved him. He was a straight A student. And what a student he was. Now, can you see in this patriarchal time, there they are sitting at dinner. And the father started the conversation. He cocks his head inevitably toward Esau. It's clear in the scripture that his favorite was Esau. And Esau knew it. And Jacob knew it too. Jacob knew who his father favored. And as his father leaned his head toward his son Esau, he says, what did you hunt today, son? And so Esau began to tell the story, you know, and just as he did, you know, his father gulped on a piece of venison that he had. That's his son. There was a break in the conversation, and Rebecca cocked her head toward Jacob because her favorite was Jacob, and Jacob knew it, and so did Esau. And she said, what did you study today, son? And Jacob said, well, mother, sinking into the rhetorical verbosities of incongruent attitudes, I would say that the hypercriticisms of the situation have been surveyed to such a point. And just then Esau let out a huge sigh, as much as to say, my brother's a sissy. And all Jacob could think of was, my brother doesn't have very much sophistication. He puts his elbows on the table when he eats, you know, and he's a bloody fellow. Now, if I am the right kind of parent, who am I for? Jacob or Esau? We had two sons, and I'll tell you which one I'm for. I'm for both of them. Our two sons are not quite as different as Esau and Jacob, but they are significantly different. And every parent knows that no matter how many children they have, they're all different. There are two sons. One of them said, Dad, I want to join the Marines and go to Vietnam. The other one said, Dad, if I'm drafted, I'm a CO and I'll go to jail first. Those are my two sons. One says, I want to join the Marines and go to Vietnam. And the other says, Dad, I'm a CO. And if they draft me, I won't go. Which one am I for? I'll tell you. I'm standing behind both of them. He's my son. And if I brought him to the age in which he's now old enough to be considered to be a citizen, I'm going to stand behind him because, right or wrong, I'm going to stand behind him. That doesn't mean I agree with everything that he says or even everything that he does. And he's my son. And though the people round about me be traditionalists and say he's a coward, I will stand behind him because he's not a coward as I see it. He's my son. He's my son and I love him. Now, we have four children, two boys and two girls, just what we ordered. When you have four children, you're bound to have one that's a little more than the rest. But they don't know it. I would not have done what Isaac and Rebekah did for anything in the world. That's a fact. I will knock myself out to make sure that no one of our children knows which one's a favorite. And I dare say that if I'd asked my wife, which I would not do, "Honey, do you have a favorite?" I rather think she has one, but I don't know who it is. I really don't. A man and a woman have to be mature enough to recognize that they are adults, and they have to function that way. But it ended up that these four people began to function like four children. The four people began to function like four children. And the interesting thing is, oftentimes a husband loves his wife. And he loves her for particular reasons, because the opposites attract. And lo and behold, now, Isaac does not love in Rebekah what he originally loved in her, but he does love what he sees of her in Esau. Esau's more like his mother, but his father loves him most. And lo and behold, if the mother doesn't see in Jacob what she originally liked in Isaac, she now denies to Isaac and gives to her son Jacob. I've never figured that out. I have seen fathers dote on daughters, and those daughters looked exactly like their wives, and they don't have a civil word for the wife. And doting on the daughter. And I have seen mothers act toward their sons, despite the fact, if I can use a slang phrase, the son was a spitting image of his father. She doesn't have a decent word for the father, and she dotes on the son. And I can illustrate that over and over again in my observation. What was wrong? I'll tell you what was wrong. The parents thought that simply being biological parents gave them every right to believe that somehow anything they did with their children was all right. And as a result, you have two of God's choice people, Isaac and Rebekah, making such an utter tragedy out of their family that ultimately the mother connives with one son against her husband to take the right away from the other son. And the father is willing to give only to that son and has to be tricked to give the honor to the son to whom God meant to give the honor. And finally, the one son has to run away and stays away for 21 years. And when he returns, his beloved mother is dead. And he cannot be with her. And I look up to God and I say, how could such a godly family make such a tragedy of it? But there it is. And I see it happening in Christian homes over and over again. Because that woman does not have the ability to expand her love. And that man doesn't have the wisdom to see his obligation and his ability also to expand his love. My wife and I have our love, our first love. And we shall keep it. And we've added children to that love. And it has not subtracted from that love. The second one is the problem of making a living. Why is it that in counseling, the number one problem that almost always comes up is money? Well, that's so large a problem, I'll reserve that some other year, some other time. But money is the problem. This oftentimes then relates itself back to what the man does for a living. Each man or woman, as the case may be, and may I use man in the generic sense, I am not a person that believes what is commonly believed in the church. The woman has always labored. And she labored equally to her husband until this century. Until this century. Where because of urbanization and the development of power tools and all the rest of it, her life has changed. You see, when I was a boy, I lived on a farm and there was no question about it. If someone said, well, the mother's place is in the home, the answer was, yes, her place was in the home, but she did a fool's day's work nonetheless. She did the chores with us, with the chickens and with the cows and with the haying and with everything else. And yet she would have said, my place is in the home. But you see, in all of this development, now that we have changed our whole lifestyle, we still keep the old interpretation and imply that this must also be the present interpretation. That too will take too much time. Just hold on to it, nevertheless. This man decided that this was his job. This was the way he was going to make his living. Now, he couldn't do it like Abraham did. Abraham could take virgin territory and hew out for himself a great living. The reason why Isaac could make a great living was he inherited it from his father. And for a time, he didn't do as well as his father. Why? Because the Philistines came in and filled up all of the oases that his father owned. Now, what did Isaac do about it? He didn't do anything about it. I would have, because I'm a competitive person. I'm just put together that way. You know, I love competition. I love to see it happening all the time. My wife isn't that way. She's gentle and loving and soft and it's none of your business. Anyway, you know, she contributes this particular... That's the way she is. And I do not expect her to do what I like to do. And I must presume the way she treats me, she doesn't expect me to do what she likes to do as far as her nature is concerned. She's not competitive, but I am. Isaac wasn't competitive. His father was. So they filled it up, and they filled up all these wells. He waited until their heat had cooled against his father. They wouldn't have dared do that when Abraham was alive. Abraham would have gone up there, and they would have known something. Read the chapter of the five kings against the four kings in the war. No question about it, but Isaac wouldn't fight. See, Isaac was with my son who said, Dad, I won't kill. That's Isaac. But he waited for a while, and then he went up, and he says, we're going to go up to that oasis. They've forgotten about it. They've ruined it anyway, and we'll clean it up. They went up and cleaned out the well and took out all the rock and the debris out, and the water came up, and he began to water his herds. And then the herdmen of Gerar came in and said, we want the water. What would you have done? I would have stood up and said, this is my property. But Isaac didn't. Why? Because Isaac is Isaac. That's the reason why. He went home, told his wife, he says, my father has another one up the pike here. We'll go up there. She didn't like it, but she went up. And they cleaned out the well, and before you know it, some other herdman came and said, this is our water. We'll take it. And I can just see Isaac going home that night. Boy, what's the conversation going to be like tonight? So he starts in, honey, or whatever you say in Hebrew. You know. We're going to have to move. That was a bad sentence. We're going to have to move. She says, move. We just came here. I just hung the drapes. You know, that settles it. That settles it. And I imagine he had all kinds of trouble. And she says, why don't you defend what's yours? You see, all she could remember was his father. And she admired his father, even though she didn't know him until he was old. And she remembered Laban, her brother, in the far country, to whom she was going to send her beloved son to learn a little bit that his father didn't teach him, and which Laban taught him. And as a consequence of all of this, you can see what's happening between them. I've seen women who've abused their husbands, or vice versa, if the shoes are switched. That's what he wanted to be. When she married him, that's what he wanted to be. A woman came and sat in my office and says, I don't want to be married to a farmer. I said, wait a minute. I performed the ceremony, and I know your husband, and I know what he's always been, and I know what he always wanted to be. Did he promise you he was going to be anything but a farmer? No. He was a farmer when you met him. And I said, he loves farming. He adores it. He loves farming, and he's a pretty good farmer. Doesn't make any money, but he's a pretty good farmer. She said she wanted a little more sophistication. She wanted to be in the society of the town. I said, honey, you go right back there and live with your husband. And he's going to be a farmer, and you're going to be a farmer's wife, and that's the way it is. Oh, but don't I have any rights? I said, you had your rights, and you have them now. But a part of them is that you made a commitment, and you have no right to make him something that he is not and never will be. When I get into a taxi cab, no matter where it is, even New York, where the most miserable taxi drivers in the world are, when I get in a taxi cab, believe it or not, and it's a good thing I do it when I get in because I don't feel in any spirit of prayer after I talk to them, usually. But when I get in the taxi cab, I always say, thank God for the taxi driver. Because I don't want to be a taxi driver. I don't want to wrestle that thing through traffic. But thank God there are people who will. If you take a look at my hands, they're soft. They're soft. Every once in a while, I get a little callus from pushing a pin. It's very, very small. Yeah, right there it is. You can see it. But I meet people whose hands are calloused from hard work, and I thank God for them, because if it weren't for you sitting out there, I couldn't do what I'm doing. I couldn't do my thing. I respect every man that tills the soil and every man that cleans a chimney and every man that drives a cab and every man that does his work, every man that stands along the line as those automobiles come by and he puts right wheels on it. We figured it out, you know. Oh. I've often wondered what a wife thinks about whose husband runs a jackhammer. You know? He comes home at night, when's dinner, dear? When's dinner? There are some people put together so that they can go to work at 8 o'clock in the morning and check in. And they have a time card and they put it in the slot and they go to their job and they come off at 5 o'clock and they put that time card in, they stamp it. My answer is, thank God for that man, but that would drive me out of my tree. See? I work all the time down in that beautiful cottage that they gave me. The place is loaded with my work. I'm writing 2 books at the present time, and I am just in my paradise. God has given that to me. My wife looks at me and says, you ever stop? But you see, that's what God has given me, and God has given you the particular thing that you're doing. And let every man remain in that calling wherein he was called. This is the scripture. And every man, every woman, whoever fits my picture, ought to be honored by his or her mate and by the children for what he is doing. God gave him that job. And Isaac was a puncher-inner and a puncher-outer. His father wasn't. But that was the way God made Isaac. And Isaac was a good worker. Not particularly creative, but he was a good worker. And he was willing to be himself. And one of the troubles with his wife was she wouldn't accept him for what he was. Last of all, I have only 5 minutes for one of the important ones. When finally Esau lost his birthright, what happened? Esau did what our children often do. When our children feel that they have not been treated fairly, and by the way, all of your children at one time or another will feel that everyone else got a better deal than he did. Don't forget that. And you've got to allow for that, and you've got to believe that given his particular psychology of the moment, you'd believe the same thing. Don't just pass it off. Try to explain it to him. And explain it in love. Explain it so that by the time you're through explaining, he thinks maybe he's got a little bit better than the rest of them. See? So you've got to allow that. Now here's Esau. He's left out. His father, who had shown him favoritism and had stood as a bulwark against his mother and his other brother, has now given in, and lo and behold, if his brother Jacob doesn't have his birthright. And it appears now to Esau that out of the four of them, they were formerly 2-2 standoff. Now they're 3-1 against him. So what'll he do? He'll do what most young people say they'd do. I'll get back at my folks. And how can they bring you to grief? They can bring you to grief by destroying themselves. Almost every kid at one time or another thinks, what can I do to myself that will bring grief to my parents? We already have studies to show that in some instances, the reason why some kids go on drugs, a great many of them go on drugs, is to get at their parents. They want to get at their parents. I remember when I was a little boy, I'd been punished by my mother. I'm sure I was innocent. I don't remember what it was, but I'm sure I was innocent. You know. I remember going into my mother's bedroom and crawling under the bed, and I prayed desperately. I prayed, oh, Lord, kill me. And when Mother comes into the bedroom to clean the room, she'll find me dead, and she'll be sorry for what she did. She'll be sorry for what she did. A couple of years after I did that, I told my mother what I had done because it stuck so brilliantly in my mind. And she laughed. I said, "What are you laughing at?" She said, "When I was a little girl, I crawled under the house. Their house was built up on blocks." She was way out in southern Georgia. And she said the hogs and the chickens would go under the house. He'd oftentimes under the house. She said, "I crawled in the middle of the... When my father had punished me, I crawled in the middle of the house underneath, and I prayed that a pig would come and lay down on me and kill me so my father would be sorry that he punished me." So my mother outdid me. I wanted God to do it, and she wanted the pigs to do it. You know, all of us, especially when we're young, we go through what I call the poor me's. It's a terrible disease. Poor me. Nobody has it as bad as I have. And adults continue, you know, this martyr complex. Poor me. No one has it as bad as I do. That old beast I live with, you know. And before you know it, you've got yourself really down at the bottom of the ladder. Poor me. And as a result, we begin to do all kinds of things that are certainly immature. And one of the finest things that will ever be said of you is that he is Christian and mature. To have the maturity of Christ on me is one of the most wonderful things that I could ever imagine in my life, to develop maturity. Now, how do you do that? Quickly. And I can only take one aspect. You must develop integrity in your children. No other way to go. You must develop integrity in your children so that they will not destroy themselves in the hopes of getting back at you or any other one of a series of things that they can do to show immaturity. You see, Esau was immature. He said, "I'll marry those two women. I'll marry those two women, those two Hittite women." He didn't think in the terms of making himself happy. He thought in the terms, "I'll get back at my folks. What do they want more than anything else? They want me to marry in my faith. They want me to marry a person whom they can respect. I'll not only marry one, but I'll marry two. I'll marry two Hittite women." And you read in the last verse of the 26th chapter, they were a grief of mind to Isaac and Rebekah. That's exactly what he planned. Esau didn't really much care about his own domestic peace. He was trying to get at his folks, so he destroyed his own relationship in an attempt to make them sorry, and he did it. Now, how do you avoid that in a child? You teach him integrity. How do you teach him integrity? A lot of ways, but one way is to teach him to make decisions. Teach him to make decisions right from the beginning. Stop making your children's decisions. Make them make their own decisions. And build within them the kinds of inner resources so they'll make the right decisions. We started out, you know, with our children, "Who do you want to put you to bed, Mommy or Daddy?" We didn't ask them if they wanted to go to bed. You see, that had already been decided. "Who do you want to put you to bed, Mommy or Daddy?" And they'd have to decide. Once in a while, I would lose and put them to bed. I can still remember our 19-year-old Jody when she sat in, for the first time, make her own decisions about what shoes she should wear. We were in that shoe store in Spokane, Washington. And while we were sitting there, he had six pairs of shoes out in front of her. I said, "Honey, you've got to decide which shoes." Now, she didn't know that we would not let the man bring out any shoes that we wouldn't accept to begin with. That's a little tricky way to go, but it's nevertheless a way to go. In other words, we didn't care what pair of the six. We weren't going to have a dozen others that we would reject. But you see, what we were teaching Jody was to make a decision. And she said, "Daddy, you make it." I said, "I'm not going to make it." And my wife, after a while, the whole thing became embarrassing. The fellow was standing there waiting to sell shoes, you know. And she says, "Decide this time." I said, no. And I said to Jody, "Honey, if you don't decide what shoes you're going to buy, we're going to walk out of this store with no shoes at all, except the ones you wore in. And besides that, no matter what shoes you buy, you decide we're going to buy, there's not enough profit in them to pay this store for having sold them to you. We've been here that long." Finally, rather than go out of the store with no shoes at all, she made her decision. She's 19 years old. You just try, double dog dare try you to make it a decision for her now. And when a boy came along and wanted her to go to bed, she says, "I don't have any time for that now. I've got a few other things to do before I get married." What had happened? We had worked and worked and worked to build the integrity within her, and so that by the time our children were 15 years of age, we didn't have to fret. We kept our hands tight at the beginning and slowly lifted them off, until we could let go. Our neighbors instead left them all off at the beginning. And while the children chopped up the piano, aren't they cute? You know. And then when they got to be 13, 14, 15, down came the hands. It won't work. It will not work. But they were obedient when they were two. They were obedient when they were three. And we began to build integrity within them and get them to make decisions, and they began to make those decisions so that by the time they were 13, 14 years of age, we didn't have to worry. Because within them was built the ability to make decisions. Today, the college students sit by my desk in my office and say, decisions, decisions, decisions. And I say, what's the matter, honey? Didn't your folks teach you how to make decisions? No, I've never really made a decision for myself. And one girl walked up and down, she said, look at me, and I thought, boy, this is, you know, she had a white blouse on, and it looked funny to me, the way she was walking. She said, I just want you to notice this blouse. I says, I notice it. And I said, what's so great about it? She says, it's the first blouse I ever ironed in my life. A college student. I said, do you mean to say that you've never done anything for yourself? She says, I came all the way from Maryland, as far as I could go to college, so I could get away from my mother, who's made all my decisions and done everything for me. I am now going to start to grow up. No integrity, but oh, how she wanted it, and I could see that she was going to get it. Shall we pray? Our Father, help us. Help us to become the parents we ought to become, to reserve the maturity, the grace, the love for one another, husband for wife, wife for husband, and that out of such strength, our children will learn the kind of integrity and commitment that they need to do the things that must be done for Jesus' sake. Amen.